Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show.
Welcome everyone to Talking About Organizations podcast, episode 71.
Hello, my name is Miranda, calling from Leamington Spa in the UK.
Hello, I'm Catherine, calling from rural Northamptonshire in the Midlands of the UK.
And I'm Greta, calling in from a very little village in Sweden called Undenäs. And today we are discussing two books. The first one is Melvin Dalton's famous book, Men Who Manage: Fusions of Feeling and Theory in Administration. It was originally published in 1959 by Wiley Books and re-released in 2017 by Routledge. And we will also be discussing Judy Weissman's book, Managing Like Men: Women and Men in Corporate Management, published in 1998 by Polity Press. And we're very honored to have Judy Weissman joining us in part two of this episode to discuss her book. This is the first all-women's episode of the podcast, and it's a bit of a deviation from normal because we will be discussing two books, and we will connect them. And the idea of this all-women's episode came with the title of the Dalton book about men who manage. You know, also the time it was written in the 50s, you know, the idea that, you know, a manager is a man. My dear friend Judy, who I've known for several years now, as we were both working at the Oxford Internet Institute, one of her books in the 90s was exactly about that, about assumptions about management and the role of gender in management. And that kind of motivated us to connect those two in this episode. So this is part one of the episode. We will first focus on the findings of Dalton's book regarding how business and industrial managers manage their firms. Miranda, would you like to start giving us a summary?
Yes, thank you, Greta. So in terms of summary, I think the first thing to kind of say about this book is, besides the year in which it was published, so 1950s, borderline 60s, is that it is the result of a very extensive and very well-conducted ethnographic study within a chemical plant in the US, in the Midwest, and with a focus on the management practices that emerged within this organization. The kind of main theme of this, or the main area of focus of this book, is the interactions between managers, among managers, but also between managers and workers and managers and firms. And what Dalton emphasizes is six areas of concerns or of pressures. So the economies of operation, this constant search for a more cost-efficient and effective way of operating, but also the dynamics of cooperation between the various individuals within the organization, within the organizational chart, that are endowed with different levels of formal or informal power. Another interesting point is the conflicts between union and management and how these are managed and negotiated, but also the uncertainties to a place in middle and upper management. Final themes that are described within the book are the differences in contributions and rewards, but also the moral conflicts of managers. And these are the six areas that Dalton organizes his observations and his considerations around this organization. However, what I find particularly interesting is possibly two ongoing themes that I'd like to pull out as a red thread. And one of them has to do with the comparison of power on a formal and informal level. And the other one has to do with the constant search for like a compromise. So this idea of finding solutions towards flexibility, towards the balancing of personal and organizational goals, which are described in an ongoing manner by the author.
Great. Thank you, Miranda. Yeah. So let's open up the discussion of Dalton's book. So I really, really enjoyed reading this book. And actually, I found myself several times during the week sitting at the dining table and reciting some of the quotes of the book to the people I was having dinner with in the home. And it's just so lively written. And like I was just reflecting on that. Like it's a book written in the 50s. It's based on 10 years of research into several corporations, but mainly the one that he calls Milo, if I recall it well. And you really see that the level of ethnographic detail in there, the sociological view that Melville Dalton brings into his study, and how he brings the corporation to life. And that's, I find, like a real talent that he has, and that really comes forth in the writing, that I really enjoyed. And the other reason why I enjoyed it was that I recognized so much of it, even though like this research was done in the 50s. So I've done research in a Japanese multinational. I also went to their factories, and both in the Netherlands and different sites, as well as in Japan. And so much of the dynamics of organizational life in production companies, they're still valid today. And I loved how the recognition that brought. And I was like, well, every person leading a manufacturing plant should read this book to understand like the different tensions that steer how work is actually being conducted and how organizations are being run. And Miranda, you brought that to the fore very well in the summary, looking at, you know, like the role of unions, for instance, like how strong that is in that context, which might be very different in, for instance, service in the service economy and companies that are operating in that industry. Also, the conflicts between staff and line are very nicely depicted in the book. And indeed, like the formal and informal, I really loved how that's like an ongoing thread throughout all the different chapters.
Absolutely. I really, really enjoyed the book as well. It's a really accessible book for anybody to read. And even though it is quite dated, as you would expect, as it was written in 1959, in parts, it is extremely relevant, and particularly for practitioners, and we can delve into that a little bit later. But I was just looking at, you know, the context of the times. In 1959, the Barbie doll was launched, and Nixon and Khrushchev had their kitchen debate, and people were watching Ben-Hur and Some Like It hot in the movies. It was an interesting time. And this book really is a classic study, I think, of the Chicago School of Sociology. You know, its contemporaries in terms of publications at the time were books like Hughes's Men and Their Work, and Goffman's The Presentation of Self and Everybody, like in everyday life. And it's a great read for practitioners. It offers real insights into how the workplace works, what the rules are in practice, and shows how rules move from being sacred guides to flexible tools in balancing the company's goals, really, and the personal ends. But the bit that got me on a personal level about Melville Dalton was actually looking into a little bit into his life, because I was interested to know a little bit about him. And he had a really tragic start. He lost all of his family as a child and lived in poverty in Indiana, and worked as a bellhop to support himself, and then managed, despite having any high school education whatsoever, to get himself into the University of Chicago with a master's, got himself admitted, and ended up doing a PhD. And there's little aspects of that, I think, that come through in parts of the text, perhaps what his own history is in how do you succeed? How do you get on, particularly the elements that are about career path? So maybe we can delve into that a little bit more later on.
Definitely. That's also like one of the chapters that I really enjoyed is chapter 6 on the managerial career ladder, and how he gave like kind of the formal account of managers within Milo about like what are the skills, what are the characteristics for people to progress on the managerial career. And there is like this more formal account of, you know, it really is an accomplishment, etc. And then we have like these two groups of people inside the company, these two groups of managers. And one group is the masons, Eric is talking about, and the other group is the people that are not masons, that don't identify as such. And let's start with the second group, where when you ask them, like, how do you get ahead on the career ladder within the company? They mention three things, and one is being the masons, and two is the boat club, if I recollect well. And I believe the third one is, I think, the access to the cafeteria. Was that the one? Is it the lunches that matter? And so it all referred to the social networks, the social relations. And that's also where he hinted that sometimes the role of the manager's wives, that it was not only the socialization at work, but also outside in social engagements outside of work, like at the boat club, where they had these networks. And you had to make sure you're connected to the right people, having the right conversations at the right time. And when there is a story of this one manager that was part of the Masons and brought in a lot of other managers into the company as well that were Masons. And that part he also had conversations with, and they didn't emphasize that being a Mason mattered, while all the others said it did matter. It was the most important thing. And the ones that did that said it didn't matter, they said, oh, it's all about accomplishments. I have worked very hard and always delivered what I said I would deliver. And so you have all these different voices about what is actually the most important thing in going up in a career ladder, and how this socialization into particular groups matters. And that's also where perhaps in the beginning, which is presented as sort of his theoretical frameworks of cliques, the role of cliques in the organization, and how you can have horizontal cliques and vertical ones as a way to capture like these social dynamics that he is describing so vividly.
I think this is a really interesting point, and I think it builds into possibly what I interpreted as Dalton's sort of approach to his ethnographic study, which is a fine balancing between theory and how things should work, so the more formal level, but also what is actually happening. So I really appreciate this book because on the one hand, it does keep the theory and the formal like organization, and it acknowledges it, but it just integrates it with a more practical perspective on how things actually work. And some of this is of informal nature. Some of it has to do with possibly our human nature of how we socialize and what we kind of prefer. But a lot of it has to do with this sort of constant compromise and maybe a respect for the organization, but putting in things so that we kind of get around things. And I think this concept of working around, particularly with the union topic that maybe we'll talk about later, is also really, really important, and is possibly the part that is the most timeless, because if we look at whatever is going on today in our workplaces, but also in other areas of life, there is always this constant compromise and working around and sort of winging it to a certain extent and having small rules that are actually not formal. And I think this is a really, really, really good way of representing the organization and bringing from it takeaways and insights that can be applied elsewhere.
Yeah, I agree, Miranda. It really illuminates, you know, the compromises of daily life at work absolutely brilliantly. It seems strangely undated in lots of ways, with the exception, of course, of the total omission of women practically entirely, except for a very small footnote much later on in the book. But it is a real practical guide to navigate work. And I suppose of its time, it must have been quite revolutionary when it came out, because I think he was the first person to really paint that picture of the social dramas at work and to, you know, show, as he does in it, an organizational structure and chart of how the company is organized, but also then maps where the influence is, which I thought was a really interesting aspect of it as well. And we see Hardy, I think it is, whose role is not hugely senior. He is in senior management, and how key he is. He's the center of all of the influence and power in the organization as well. Do we want to talk a little bit about what managers are at Milo as well? He uses this description of unequivocal managers.
Yeah, that Hardy figure was really a central figure in the Milo plans. And one of the things that I believe the Dalton book is particularly famous of is what he presents in the first chapter, and where he gives like the formal organizational chart of the key figures in his ethnography, and shows where they are positioned as managers in the hierarchy, which is like the formal organizational hierarchy as it is on paper and the formal lines of responsibility, who is the superior, who is the subordinate. But then he also provides this picture of the informal power of the people. And you see that some of the managers that are quite low in the formal hierarchy are actually very, very high up in the informal hierarchy of the organization, and how actually decisions get made, how work is being done, and who has a say about the operations in the plant. And I really loved like the way he visualized that and how he abstracted that from his ethnographic data.
It almost has some soap opera-like qualities to it, the descriptions of the individuals. It's very, very entertaining, definitely. And he really, really brings that to life. And I guess he was the first, possibly, to do that.
I think this is the point when I was reading the book, when I thought, when I went back to like the title and the subtitle, is that a thing in English? The extended version of the title. So it's called Men Who Manage, and that's fine. Fusions of Feeling and Theory in Administration. And I think it's the point where I read about the power struggles, and especially the line staff. And I have a bit more of ability to kind of maybe put myself in their shoes and think more about not being acknowledged within the organizational chart at a certain level, but actually knowing your value and having that sort of desire to prove that you are a valuable piece of the organization. And I think there you start to have a bit more of this feeling side. And I think that's the part where actually this book really starts to come to life, and it starts to be something very much relatable, whatever your job or your everyday life looks like.
Yeah, just an example of some of the descriptions of people are very interesting. Stevens was a rejected former mason past 60. Lane was not sharp enough to deal over and under the table at the same time. That was his downfall. Revere was a widower with married children, so therefore not very powerful. Schnell, his job promotion was a shelter from intolerable conflicts. I thought that was a fantastic way to describe how people often get sidelined in organizations and moved sideways in organizations. And Knight is obviously the brains of the operation as well. But it is a really amazing picture that, and a very illuminating picture of where informal power is. And it's something that we're all aware of in organizations that we work in, and is rarely mapped, I think it would be fair to say. I'm not sure if many did this after him either.
Yeah, I agree, Catherine. And you know, it might also have to do with, you know, the possibility of being able to do such detailed fieldwork. And Melville Dalton also himself acknowledges that first top management was super supportive and gave him access for the research. But once they figured out what he actually was studying, the doors closed again. And yeah, perhaps it also points to the role of gender in being able to get that access and get people to open up to you. But one thing I wanted to bring up in relation to our conversation is the cafeteria that's being discussed, especially in the chapter on the relations between staff and line. And here I have an example of one of the quotes that I think illustrates like how what beautiful type of data he collected. And this is about the role of the cafeteria. So the cafeteria was not just like a factory cafeteria. No, you had to be part of the invite-only group, and it was one of the assistants to the CEO or the factory leader to decide who had access to this group, to the cafeteria. And there are also some general foremen that have access to it, but they despise the way staff managers act. Like, they despise how they have their formal appearances, their nice clothing, how they try to keep up appearances. And so while the cafeteria was intended to facilitate these informal conversations between staff and line managers, the line managers, the foremen, actually don't really like to go there. So let me read this quote. There's a lot of good discussion in the cafeteria. I like to get in on more of it, but I don't like to go there. Sometimes I have to go. Most of the white-collar people, staff officers, that eat there are stuck up. I've been introduced 3 times to Swenson, yet when I meet him, he pretends to not even know me. When he meets me on the street, he always manages to be looking someplace else. God damn such people as that. They don't go into the cafeteria to eat and relax while they talk over the problems. They go in there to look around and see how somebody is dressed or to talk over the hot party they had last night. Well, that kind of damn stuff don't go with me. I haven't any time to put on airs and make out I'm something that I'm not. I really loved, like, this, you know, it's like you said, it almost has soap opera quality of some of the material he's working with. And I guess it also shows a bit like the relations that Melville Dalton has with his informants as he conducted his work.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing that he was able to dedicate 10 years of his life to this organization. And I think there was 3 other organizations as well that he references in it, because I guess that just would never happen now, would it be fair to say, for a long-term, you know, ethnographic qualitative piece of research. So that makes it even more important.
If I can add upon the sort of cafeteria vignette and the quality of the data, I was actually wondering while we were sort of discussing this, how much the background of the author enabled him to get this level of quality and understanding and trust of the informants to be able to reveal these sort of most inner, darker comments, which go beyond the, how do you find the work environment? Yeah, it's okay, blah, blah. So I think this is a really good one to think about, and possibly even the fact that it was an extensive piece of ethnographic research that probably, I mean, maybe this was data that actually goes to the final phases. It may not be the type of data that he was able to collect in the first phases, but I don't know. This is just conjecture. A second thing, and I don't know if we're sort of maybe spoiling things to be said in the second part, but these conversations, I read about them, or I read about reflections that are quite similar in modern workplaces within this idea of like the boys' club, the boys working, the working drink event, and so on, while especially, not to say exclusively female member of staff, but members of staff that have other family commitments, other things that bring them home, cannot take part. And a lot of the important informal decisions or conversations or pieces of information are actually exchanged in these extra after 5 o'clock events. And the third thing that I just throw out there, maybe to tie into the current developments in the workplace, I'm wondering if actually one of the benefits of working from home, whether it be because of the COVID pandemic or some sort of working arrangement, is actually that we don't have to go through all of this drama of the cafeteria, of the being forced to be somewhere with people that you're not that keen on, and you just want to get your work done and that's it. But this is like an open point, so free to chip in or leave it as such.
I've been also thinking about that, Miranda, like how much is it a blessing or a curse to organizing that informal parts, that unorganized part of social encounters through which all these micro level things get synchronized and agreed and support for certain decisions is being created, that has fallen away. You know, the one thing that Dalton's book shows is that it's as much of that, like there's one of the informants that says, like, this is it's as political here, perhaps even more political than Washington. And so that's what it shows. And I had some conversations with my dad about it, and he has been working as a doctor before he retired. It's like, you know, this is in every industry, this is in every profession, whether it's inside an organization or more in a broader network, where you always have to align all these different interests of different groups of actors and people. And that's what he so nicely describes, like getting support for change, like the compromises you have to make, you know, the negotiations with the unions, where often small cases got sacrificed in order to get the big cases pushed through. Also, for instance, like there's this example about health and safety regulation, like in a production organization. You know, safety in the factory is like of key importance, and you have to follow the rules. But what you see is that it's conflicting with the managerial instructions for productivity, increased productivity. And so you see how all these conflicting interests, and, you know, in modern language, we would say like conflicting institutional logics inside the organization, and how that's being played out at the level of the work floor, where a worker in the end has to make one decision or the other. And everything that shapes that is revealed so beautifully. And one example that I can recall is this example of the factory shoes, like these working shoes, you know, these shoes that are very hard. And the factory men don't like to wear those shoes. They think they're ugly, they're heavy. And so every complaint, the health and safety department orders a new type of shoe to stimulate that the factory men are wearing them. And in the end, they even produce them in different colors. And then Dalton remarks, like, you know, those shoes were particularly in demand by the older generations that wore them outside of work hours. I thought that was a nice note. But there is this example of one of the guys, he breaks his toes. And instead of going to the on-site hospital or health department, they actually take him to a private doctor. It's the factory lead that takes him to the private doctor. And the reason is, if they would go to the on-site one, they had to make a report, and there was a health and safety violation. And like every risk in the factory had been taken care of. So if there was a health risk, then a rule had been broken, and it was of utmost importance to not to show like how many rules got broken on a daily basis. And so this guy goes to the private doctor, and instead of, you know, being at home for his toes to heal, he is being picked up from the home every day, and they put his card in the machine to lock his hours of working. And he's just sitting there on the side of the production floor doing nothing, just to make sure that no one notices like that the accident has happened. I loved like the rich and vivid detail that was given there, and to show like how, I guess how at the level of everyday work, showing the adherence to the formal rules while having to deal with the reality as it is, there's and coming up with all these workarounds as a way to just cope. And that just coping is it's also in the foreword that is given by David Shulman, the foreword that's given by George Hildebrandt. He also mentions that just coping, how to get on with managing in practice, that is, I think, like the most powerful part of the book. At the same time, I was also reflecting on, okay, how has work and how has managing changed over time? Like, a lot what he talks about is still the same, but like our workforce is way more diverse. What we also see, this is a setting where people have long tenure. Like some of the workmen worked there for over 30 years. Dalton was there for over 10 years to conduct his field work. So there are long-term relations. And when you think about like the political nature of just getting work done and getting agreement on how to execute it. So there were all these different political influences that are being described in the book, but at least because the actors were kind of stable, you kind of knew what the challenges were. in pushing through decisions, in implementing regulation, or improving just the technology of the machinery on the factory floor. But when you look now at organizations today, people are changing all the time. And, you know, every 3 years, you know, your career is not within an organization. Most often it's multiple ones. So what extra type of complications, like when we think about work now, is it less political than described in the Dalton book, or has it become more political but less predictable in a sense? What do you think?
I don't know if any research has sort of talked about these sort of things, but my intuition, based on a number of different settings, which are very, very various, let's put it that way, is that possibly the more time people are within an organization or some sort of setup, the more the informal power and the feelings around that strengthen. So to give an example from a very different context, in Italy, we have blocks of flats and they're managed by like some sort of central body. And every year there's a meeting, what to do, what to paint, where to put the money and so on. So what is the priority of the tasks? And it's always a battleground. And the battleground is particularly severe when there are residents within the block of flats that have been there for quite a long time. While those that have just moved in, they are sort of, they feel powerless and they don't have all of the informal power or knowledge to kind of build their case as to why this should be done first or why that and so on. So I think this is like a very everyday example, but I feel that because I've seen a lot of the battles going on, I think it could be one way of framing it, but I'm open to hear other views.
I think as well, maybe there's a distinction to be drawn between power and influence here as well. Because in our podcast episode on Dan Brass's article about social network theory, we see how you can build your social capital, particularly if you've been in an organization for a long time, and that may make you very influential. That may not be mirrored in your formal role, but you have influence and therefore a certain level of informal power. But that actually, at the end of the day, Brass's theory was that formal power trumps informal power at the end of the day. So even though we draw this messy map of complex, messy organizations and where the power and the influence is, that at the end of the day, you know, if somebody's your boss and they want to sack you, they still can sack you regardless of your influence.
So I wonder if that then is a change from, you know, the setting that Dalton wrote about, where he kind of makes the claim that, you know, the informal power matters like as much or even more than the formal one. For instance, in chapter one, he writes who actually the head of the factory, how little power he actually had and who was actually running the plant. Yeah, what do you think? Do you think that because, you know, the types of organizations that we study today, or because career progression is not within one organization, that led to a change in dynamics? Or what do you think?
I think that there's a difference between real power and influence and what influence is. I think there's a huge amount in any organization of informal power that comes from levels of influence. But, you know, I would agree with Brass that at the end of the day, the formal power does trump informal power that comes through influence, definitely. However, where Dalton's book is really helpful is opening up to an individual how the fact that this is how you navigate an organization if you are to be successful within it, basically. It's like a guide how to, as a man, certainly, in an organization, how important it is to build your social capital. How you're going to have to accept challenges to your ethics, in fact, in terms of what you're willing to do and what you're not willing to do and what you're willing to accept and not to actually be successful. And there's, you know, so many stories from his informants. There's one story in it where an individual, a former manager, quite senior, had actually left the organization, and the company was still going out and repairing, I think, his garage, where some of the men were sent out to fix it. You know, it brought back to me all those stories in the news about MPs in the UK when they were, one guy had claimed, was it a duck house? Basically, how pervasive this acceptance of, you know, what is ethically wrong is in organizations sometimes. But Dalton's view is that, you know, and whether we agree with it or not, sometimes that's necessary to get the job done. So I've kind of diverted a bit there from power and influence. But obviously, if you are on the side or you are in with the people who are doing this, then that by its nature, if that is the accepted way of how things are done around here, that gives you power and influence if you accept that way of working. And that's very hard to change and very hard to break. And Dalton does say that Milo was a very successful company and from the outside had absolutely nothing wrong with it. Maybe was a, you know, a beacon of what a large, you know, corporation, a chemical plant in mid-America should be like. But underneath the surface was this mega drama, mega social drama of the reality of how messy and complex and sometimes even unethical working life is behind the scenes. Just to say about Miranda's point as well about Dalton as a researcher, he does describe himself in the foreword as a marginal researcher. You know, I don't know if he would have described himself as a practitioner scholar. So I think there he's possibly acknowledging the fact that by describing himself as marginal, that he felt he had a leg in both camps, and that certainly supported him being accepted by his informants over 10 years. You know, he probably talked like them. He probably looked like them. And that is why his data is so successful and so rich as a result as well.
Yeah, no, I thank you for describing and looking up his background, Catherine. That indeed, like, it helps you understand, like, how he connected with his informants, how very easily integrated with them. But I was also thinking about the amount of emotional work that goes into building good fieldwork relations, and having done ethnographies at difficult settings. I realize how much emotional work goes into it. And thinking about, you know, having lost his family, thinking about the position of work in his life as an academic, building those relations, yeah, makes sense of, they resonate. You read it in between the lines, so to say.
I don't know if we want to go back to the whole career ladder thing, because, you know, that could be a whole, we could just look at that chapter. We could have picked that chapter out just by itself and just picked it apart, really. But because there's so many kind of elements of it that are really interesting, you know, basically, in summary, the view is make sure that people are ideally technically fit for the job first and foremost. And then secondary to that, and pretty essential to their own career progression, can they deal with the internal tensions and the subtlety of the group dynamics of where they work? But the leadership situation, I don't know if we want to talk about that a little bit. So again, that's one of the successes of the book. You know, why this is a classic is probably because he was one of the first to actually discuss what being a leader means in reality and how challenging it is, and the constant compromises that are involved in it.
And that's also where he brings up, like, it goes throughout our conversation, the amount of socialization, being part of the right cliques, as he presented it, being part of the right groups, and especially, like, when he talks about the dynamics among the managers in the staff departments, where he says, like, you know, like, they had way more time to socialize. And often, you know, they had, like, hour-long conversations about whether, you know, they actually made a contribution to the company. The morning breakfasts, you know, at 10 a.m. With their buns and their coffee. And when senior managers in the staff wanted to get a promotion, how he reprimanded his staff and they should behave better and, you know, keep up appearances, etc. And here I am thinking about, you know, thinking about that time, like, it's also acknowledged in the beginning that most of these managers were white men. And thinking about the role of these social networks that you brought up, Catherine, has it changed at all? like when we look at the increasing diversity of the workforce, but that diversity not being reflected in management oftentimes. And we have a lot of, you know, programs to bring in more diversity and make management more a reflection of the representation of the workforce. But we still see that as you move up the career ladder, it's often white men in the executive positions. For people that are not men or non-white, they have difficulty to be part of those social networks, to get into it. And to what extent do you think, like, has that changed at all? Has it changed at all? And how has COVID now affected the way promotions and, you know, like, we're in a financial recession, so making decisions of who gets to keep their job, who gets fired? Like, how do things are being done right now?
Well, I think building your social capital is absolutely essential for career progression, certainly in major organizations. And I recently heard Michelle Obama actually talking about this in terms of, you know, as a Black woman and as a lawyer, how would she progress her career? And she tells a fantastic story about how when she went to university, she looked around the room and she quickly made the assessment that if she was to progress anywhere, she needed to join the wine society. She didn't know anything about wine. She had no particular interest in wine. She liked having a drink, but she had no desire to learn more about wine. But she knew that she needed to build her social capital to progress her career. And that's why she joined the wine society. And I think certainly that hasn't changed. And we may discuss it more with Judy, but there are certain social areas that are very exclusionary to women, certainly in corporate settings. Golf, even though women can play golf and are admitted to golf clubs, it's rare that those types of social occasions include women. As you say, with the current pandemic, a lot of this cannot happen. So is there opportunities there for socializing and networking that involves, you know, more than just one gender or one particular group of people? Will it become more open? I'm not quite sure yet.
Just to kind of build upon this conversation, I mean, I understand how this is the reality of organizations, but I just, when I look at it, it's it just strike a kind of sad note within me, because at the same time, I consider myself someone that has got interests that are maybe not aligned to the majority. And it just feels that maybe people who think a bit differently or are independent thinkers, they kind of get excluded from this wider picture. And I feel that in the overall scheme of things, this is actually a big shame. Like, it's really, I don't know, it strikes a sad note in me.
Well, I think it lays bare how huge the challenge is for anybody, as you say, who doesn't fit into this very clear, narrow definition of the man who manages. Is how are you going to progress, and how much tougher it is for you to get anywhere. And that is the depressing note to be sounded from the book. So it is a guide, but you better make sure you're white, you're a man, you're from a certain background to succeed in a multinational company. And maybe we can discuss with Judy later if at all anything has changed, and if it has, what the advice is. If you're from a different ethnic background or a different gender, how you can progress your career with those really serious structural challenges.
In that sense, like what I think that Dalton beautifully does is showing how organizational settings are really microcosms. They're micro societies. You know, the patterns that we see there are as much inside organizations as they are outside in wider society. And that just makes me think about, like, you know, his subtitle. I love the subtitle, "The Fusions of Feeling and Theory in Administration." And that is what it really does, and what it, the major contribution is showing how managing the feelings of people and the compromises that you have to make on a daily basis to make things work is as much part of management as just following the rules and keeping the machinery running, so to say. So with that, we are coming to a close of part one of this episode, and where we discussed Dalton's book, Men Who Manage. And in part two, we will continue our conversation. We're looking forward to have you back then.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Finally, we would like to thank some wonderful people for supporting the show. Sarah Audner, Leon Prieto, Hadi Shaheen, Marshall Reiner, Alice Barbosa, Thomas Roulet, Heiko Schmidt, Barton Friedland, Guldem Kara Mustafa, Roberto Bernardi, Marina Timmer, Bernard Hogan, Eddie Hunsinger, Fiona Knight, Peaks Craft, Timothy Paul, Willy Leidon-Wirte, Gabriel Van Bunnen, and Clara Lux. It's easy to support the show, and all you have to do is go to our website, where a donations button will greet you. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.